Hi, everyone. I'm an addict named Kathy. I was just saying to George, I've been speaking like for the past like 4 weekends straight. And when I don't usually do that. I don't usually take commitments like that. But I had gone through a crisis. And the only thing I know to do whenever I'm going through a crisis in my life is to, like, you know, do service work, like get in the middle. And I get really scared whenever I'm going through a lot of changes. So anybody that asks me to do anything during that time, I just say yes to everybody that says anything. I think I wound up with like 4 back-to-back commitments every weekend, back-to-back-to-back. I'm now the secretary of my home group. I don't know if you guys call it the sponsor or panel coordinator for an H&I commitment. I just took the ultimate GSR as well in my home group because the GSR couldn't make it to the ASC. And if I keep this up, I should be dead by next month, right? But for real, it keeps me clean. Like, I know that service work keeps me clean because it keeps me in the middle. And I'm not confused that I need to be in the middle of this program at any time. December 7th of 88 is my clean date. So, you know, if I keep putting one foot in front of the other and follow the direction I've been given, I will have 12 years clean next month. And I, you know, I'll tell you what, this past year has probably been my hardest year in recovery. This has been the most difficult time for me. I really escaped using by the skin of my teeth. I have never been this close to using as I was about 2 months ago. And it just scared me into a whole new gratitude for being clean. It scared me into a whole new, like, recommitment to recovery. And I don't see fear as being a bad thing. I really don't. Like, I think fear gets a bad rap sometimes. You know, like, a lot of people will be like, well, you know, fear is what, you know, causes me to, like, disconnect from God, and fear is what causes me to act out on defects. And, you know, anybody that's really, like, done a fourth and, you know, fifth and sixth will be like, fear is the exact nature and the core of our disease and all that stuff. But seriously, because of this program, the thing I've learned about fear is fear is an excellent motivator to connect me to God, too. I mean, with the quickness. You know, if I forget that I don't have the power, and, you know, if I forget that I'm not the one with the power, then, yeah, it connects me to the disease. But pretty much I've gotten a pretty good grip on when I'm scared, I find out I know where to go. And that's only been through a lot of practice. The tricky thing is that sometimes I don't get scared when I probably should be. And when I want something really bad, I get really self-willing. And that's kind of what took me there a couple months ago, and that's why I struggled, you know, the way I did, because God was making it very clear that it was a no, and I was insisting that it was a go. And I persevered and, you know, called that qualities and principles. A lot of times I'll do that in recovery. I've called myself practicing a principle when it was really just a defect. And I can justify and rationalize nonsense, you know, and even better. As a matter of fact, I was in the car. We were in the truck. Carrie and I were in the truck, and I twisted some stuff around. So I twisted it so fast on her, and she turned. I blamed her for something that was my fault, and I did it so quick that she said to me, "Oh, you are really good." And I was like, "Yeah, I know that I can, like, really make wrong sound right, and I can make it look like someone else's fault like that." And even, you know, like, she was sitting there thinking, then she was like, "That's, you're full of shit. That's not right." But it took her a minute, to, you know, to, like, come to terms with that. And if she didn't have a program, she would have never got it. She would have never got it because, you know, like, I can still do that with family members pretty easy. And I think sometimes I even do it just to see if I can. You know what I mean? It's almost like, you know, that, you know, you think I'd know by now not to taunt this disease, not to tease it, not to play with it. But every so often, I just, you know, feel the need for, you know, just to see how far I can go. I still have that every once in a while, like to live on the edge or, you know, just see how far I can push things and stuff. So as a result, I pushed myself almost off the edge. I usually don't do this, but for some reason, I would really like to take a minute to kind of do a shout-out, and I don't usually do shout-outs, and I don't do dedications either. And, you know, I first want to thank, you know, immensely the Free State for asking me to come again because I've been asked before and had a commitment and couldn't make it last year, as a matter of fact. And it's unusual to get asked to come back someplace again. You know, usually if you don't, you miss a shot, you miss a shot, and you don't usually get asked back again. I just think it's such an honor to be asked to come back someplace again. And I always want to thank God. I always thank God for, like, you know, bringing me. I can't even express the gratitude, and I don't even thank God enough to show the appreciation I have for being, like, saved from a life of misery and torment. I mean, I was just truly a miserable, tormented person. And I'm even talking about before the drugs. Before the drugs, I was just a very unhappy person. To be able to come here to this program and finally have a spirit that's free and able to, you know, I was saying that today, able to, like, lighten up some. Like, you know, when I first got clean, this was very serious, and I'm not saying that, like, you know, that I don't take this program serious anymore. It's just that I've learned to lighten up a little bit on myself. I don't beat myself up as much. I dust myself off more than I used to, and I'm grateful for that. But I was, the tape that was submitted for me to speak at the convention when I was asked last year was submitted by an individual that believed in me. I guess he heard something in me that offered him some hope, and he believed in me enough to submit the tape to see if I could be selected to speak for this convention. And I had a commitment in Dallas and couldn't come. And I guess the committee still, you know, had heard it and believed in me still, but the person that had submitted the tape passed away in the process, and I wasn't able to be here or meet him personally. And I just really want to take a minute to say thanks to Josh, and I made it here this year, so thanks a lot for everything and for believing in me and for even hearing something in me that I guess I don't hear in myself a lot of times. And I wanted to wish my sponsor a happy 19th anniversary. Today she has 19 years clean, and I want to take a moment to wish her a happy anniversary because I know she's in a lot of pain and she's struggling. I left Pittsburgh this afternoon. Wednesday evening I came home from work, and I got a call on the phone, and my little girl answered the phone, and she says, "Mom, Mary's on the phone." And I was in the middle of dinner and really didn't. I was like, "I'll call her back." And I guess Rhea, you know, has been around recovery enough that she kind of knows when a call back's okay and when a call back isn't okay. And she was like holding the phone, and she's going, she's crying, "No, you can't. This is not a callback call. This is a take now call." And so I went to the phone, and I got the phone, and my sponsor had been seeing a guy for, you know, a little while, and he relapsed a couple months ago, and they found him dead in the bathroom of, you know, a food store. And she was on her way down to meet the coroner to pick him up. And it just seems like over this past, like, couple months, the reality of just, like, how brutal this disease is and where it'll take us. You know, we hear that all the time. Like, you know, we say a prayer for the addict that still suffers. And, you know, I've even heard it said that some of us die so that others can live. And, you know, there's been a lot of sayings. And, you know, they all sound really interesting, but they, you know, sometimes they just hit home so hard. And it just seems like the past couple months, it's just really hit home really hard for me a lot. I sometimes, I guess, take for granted how blessed I am to be here, or, you know, overlook just how fortunate every one of us are that sit here at these tables today to be here. Like, you know, that, because there's so many people that are out there dying in so many really sad ways and places, that we're really very, very fortunate to be here. So I just wanted to take a minute to do that and say thanks, God, for so many blessings and so much grace. And a whole lot of mercy, a whole lot of mercy. And I usually say, like, if while I'm sharing, if any time I'm sharing, if my spirit touches your spirit, if you feel the feelings that go with the experiences that I'm going to share, would you take that moment to thank the God of your understanding for truly blessing us with, you know, I really got exposed to love at a deeper level over the past few months, too. I really wasn't paying close attention to, You know, I say a lot of times, and I guess we say it real freely up in here, I love you, and I love you back, and, you know, like, all the time, there's lots of love being passed around in here, and I didn't realize until the past couple months how conditional I am, and if I'm conditional, it's not love. You know, I hear a lot of times attached, like, unconditional love, which, like, you know, is so rhetorical, because love is unconditional. If it's anything but that, it's not love. And I was getting exposed a lot of times to how, like I say a lot of times, you know, to people, especially people very close to me, I love you. But then if I love you, then you're supposed to do this. Or if I love you, then you're supposed to act a certain kind of way. And if you don't act that way, then I got to go. Or if you don't act that way, then, you know, I dismiss you from my life or something like that. And that's not what love is about. And I'm getting to learn a lot better here in recovery, just some of the principles that the steps have to offer, that just when I think I know them, or just when I think I've got one, I don't have it. I'm totally off the mark with it. Every step that I've taken in this program has been a reintroduction to humility at a deeper level for me. Like, just when I think I know something, I know very little about it. And if nothing else, it's kept recovery very interesting for me, to say the least. So, I mean, if anybody's heard me share, I always like share about the steps and what the process of recovery has been for me. Because when I came in here, it was very important to me that I know what was going to happen if I did this thing. Like, I'm one of those people, and I know you are too, that likes to know the payoff before I do the work. I want to know what I'm going to get if I invest anything. Even if it's the smallest thing, I want to know what I'm going to get if I invest this. And so when I came in here and people talked about work the steps or die, or this is an inside job, or, you know, you have to change in order to grow, and I wanted to know, like, exactly if I let go of some things, what was going to happen in return. So I always kind of share about the steps being an inside job and how the first step is like being in the basement of my own house. And I share a lot about, you know, that was the other thing that's been exposed to me a lot recently, is I used to hear people say when I first got clean that the only step you have to work 100% is the first one. And I used to think to myself, what's the big deal? You admit you're powerless over your addiction, your life become unmanageable, you move on. You know, it doesn't seem like a big deal. But I'm really coming to terms a lot more with how big a deal the first step really is. That there is some major stuff that goes on with me about trying to control things, and every time I try to do it, it's always, like, after the, George was saying that when he was sharing, he was saying, like, you know, once you get to, recovery doesn't start till you get to the second step. You know, once you keep, there's plenty of times I've been in situations where I just refused. It wasn't even that I was in denial. I was in, like, total refusal. I was in complete disobedience, that I just did not want to admit that I couldn't make something happen, that I couldn't get it to go. In the same way, I mean, it might have took me decades to get here through active addiction to finally admit that using wasn't working for me. And it did. It took a long time for me to finally admit that, and I tried a lot of twists and turns and different ways to make it go, and it wasn't working for me. And I remember a lot of times I used to think, well, you know, like if I got so bad or a certain way, then I would stop. I can remember going to court, because I was just talking to Artie about Frederick, Maryland, and I was saying that I was in the penitentiary with a girl, you know, who relocated to Frederick, and when I went to a convention, I ran into her at a convention, but we were locked up together at the penitentiary. I was doing like 4, I think she was doing like 6, and it was really strange to see her in the rooms, but I remember being in the courtroom, and the judge sentencing me, and there was like 7 of us. They, you know, and I always say this, it wasn't a big deal. It was just a bunch of dope fiends doing what we had to do to get high, and they made a federal case out of it, literally. It wasn't a big deal. It really wasn't a big deal, but they made it into this big deal, you know? And I somehow would write on that, and somebody would say, did you do time? Yeah, I did federal time, you know? Like it was supposed to be better time than, you know, I did something better and bigger. I didn't. I got caught at doing something stupid that they made big. And I remember being in the courtroom and sitting in there, and the judge sentencing me to 4 years. And I thought to myself, that wasn't too bad. I didn't think, I could do 4. 4 is not too bad. And thinking to myself, and then he gave me like a 4-year special parole on top of that. And I somehow convinced myself that was because I was special that he gave me that. And I turned around and I looked at my mother and my father and my daughter who were in the back of the courtroom. And I could see my mother shaking her head and starting to cry. And I could see my father sit down because it looked like the wind was knocked out of him. And my little girl was just totally dazed. And I'm thinking to myself, what's wrong with them? Why are they so, like, jacked up? I'm the one that's got to do the time. What is their problem? Thinking at the same time to myself, well, maybe if they sit me down for 4 years, maybe I'll get it together. I mean, I'm talking about being in the basement, being so desperate, thinking that, well, maybe if they lock me up, I can get this together. Maybe that's the only way for me to get this together, if somebody just locks me up and sets me down. That all I really need is some good structure. If somebody would just give me some good structure where you get, and I'm trying to, I'll tell you what, I do well in the penitentiary. I do exceptionally well. If you tell me the rules and how they go and what time to be in what places, I can stay out of trouble, follow the rules, and I do swell. My problem is with life. If I get out, I don't know what the rules are. It's like there's no instructions to this life thing, you know? There's instructions to time, doing time. There's no instructions to doing life. And I started to realize that after about 2 decades. I don't want to say that I'm not real bright, but it took me like 2 decades to finally figure out that I needed some structure and I needed some instructions on how to live life. Because if I didn't get it, I was never going to get it. I was never going to get it. And I started to come here. When I started to come here, and I'm talking about finally coming up out of the basement where you live in the dark. I mean, you know, when the text says we're, living skills were reduced to an animal level, that was like minimal to me. That was an understatement to me. My life had become unmanageable. My hair's unmanageable. Well, my life was a disaster. I'm talking about like a major tragedy. No light at the end of the tunnel. No hope whatsoever. I really started to get jealous of the people that would overdose thinking they got out. That was the only way to get. I couldn't even overdose. I was, you know, I mean, I felt like a total failure that I couldn't even, everybody else overdosed. I couldn't get enough of it in me to even overdose. It was like I couldn't even get a minute of relief. I couldn't even get a second of relief. To me, that seemed like it was the only way to get relief and the only way to get out. And that's a really sad state of affair, to be walking around like a zombie, like the living dead, waiting to die, just waiting for somebody to take me out of here. I can remember a guy one time kidnapping me because my partner, I was going to call him my like significant other or boyfriend, but we were really just partners. Because we weren't even having much sex either. Once the drug starts getting busy, nobody else seems to. And he and I were hooked up, and a guy gave him a bunch of money to go get a bundle of dope. And somehow he got distracted, and he was late in him in returning, you know. And I guess it was one of those wait here and I'll be right back things. And he wasn't right back, and the guy came to my house and kidnapped me to get his money back or his dope, which is a really bad move because he could have cared less if he had me. That was like one less habit to support. That didn't like, what do you think? You think he cares enough about me to, and I remember this guy had me tied up and he actually like put a blindfold on me, tied me up and took me at three guys, because I was so crazy, you never knew what I might do. Three guys come and take me out of my own house. They're driving me down next to the river, and the guy says to me, you know what I'm going to do to you? I'm going to tie like cement to your feet, like cement blocks, and I'm going to throw you in the river. Now, I'm tied, and I'm blindfolded, right? And I'm getting dope sick now. So this shit isn't even funny anymore. You know what I mean? Like, at first it was amusing. Now it's not even funny anymore. And I said to him, anybody that I know that's really thorough doesn't talk about what they're going to do first. They just do it. And he, like, was, like, dumbfounded that I would be so cocky, tied up, blindfolded, talking about I'm going to kill you, because I thought to myself, for real, I thought, I'm getting sick here. I'm going to go into withdrawal. I know that. just doesn't sound like a bad move right through here. It really doesn't. If that's my way out, then that's my way out. And if he can do it quicker than I can do it, then go for it, because it's taken me way too long. Like whatever the reading said, we're slowly committing suicide. That was a brutal death. That was a very slow, brutal death for me. And I used to wake up every day. I would hear the birds outside my window every morning that I woke, and I hated those birds. I hated them. I hated them because they were singing, and I couldn't imagine what they could be so happy about. I used to think to myself, don't they know they're birds? Do they not know they're birds? And then would even think to myself, every time I would hear them, I would think, oh no, I have to do this again. Oh no, I have to get up and do this all over again. It was like a nightmare that was never going to end. And the thought of it exhausted me just waking up thinking I had to do it again. And I remember hating all that stuff, but still thinking there was no way out. I needed some sort of instructions. I needed some sort of structure, and you gave it to me. Second step is a little light starts to shine in a very dark place. And that's what Narcotics Anonymous was for me. I'm talking about coming to believe was not something that came easy for me, but it was something that I desperately needed. I was looking somewhere for some hope, for somebody just to cast a little bit of light. You know, it's amazing. It doesn't take a drop of hope will take an addict for a lifetime. I can live off a drop for a lifetime. I can really work that drop. If you could just give me a little something to go on. Because I had been to an awful lot of places for treatment. I mean, I had everybody pay for treatment. And no matter where I went, I always seemed to wind up in the same place where people would say, you know, like, you're a really nice girl, you come from a good family, you know, you're fairly intelligent, you're attractive, so why do you use? And it always, like, baffled me, because I'd be like, well, that's what I came here for, you to tell me that. And you're going to ask me the same question that I've been asking myself for 20 years. You're a nice girl that comes from a good home. What is your problem? Why do you keep using? This was the only place that I came where they didn't just ask the problem. It wasn't about just the problem. It was like whenever the reading says that we don't really, you know, we're not going to, we just want to know what you want to do about your problem and how we can help. What do you want to do about your... I didn't really, could never even identify the problem. I stayed stuck in the problem. That's why a lot of times, and I was sharing this with somebody earlier this week, we were talking about coming to meetings and sharing about the problem.